back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at RackSteel.com. Now joining us, very graciously adjusting our weekly schedule with him to join us today in studio. He's the host of the Hockey PDO cast. He is Dmitry Filipovich. What's going on, Dim?
It's the last shift of Friday, right? It's the weekend.
Oh,
after this.
I wish.
Well, let's bring the energy and make people feel
we'll
like
try. We'll try to make it feel like right before a weekend, a Friday afternoon today. We'll see how we do on that one. All right, second half of a back-to-back for the Canucks today. They play the Anaheim Ducks. Now, the Ducks do have a pretty good record recently. I mean, especially in their last 10, 7-2-1. I know Drance was saying, even you go back like 25 games, they've outperformed the Canucks. They're still kind of like technically in the playoff race, kind of at 500, 57 points in 57 games. How would you kind of describe this Ducks team this year?
Miserable.
I love it. Say no more.
I mean, on the ice, incredibly frustrating. Everything's well documented about Greg Cronin.
Yep.
Story time with Greg Cronin, the way he's been rubbing the players the wrong way. I'd argue they're up there for worst run organization right now. Just if you look at what Pat Verbeek's done, they obviously drafted very well the past couple of years, been picking high in the draft, accumulating future talent, but they've also leveraged their cap space, which they've had in abundance, so poorly, just giving out flyers and helping out other teams who are in a bind. I mean, the relationship between Steve Yzerman and Pat Verbeek certainly played in this, and two good pals helping each other out, but just taking Ville Husso's buried $3.6 million for no reason with getting no future assets in return is insane.
Just for fun.
In my opinion, yeah. This is a competitive business where there's 32 organizations and you're just letting someone off the hook like that. Makes no sense to me. They keep doing this. Trouba as
right.
well.
Yep.
The contracts they've given to guys like Strome and Kalorn in the past couple years. We're seeing a bit of progress in terms of results. You mentioned the last 10 games, the most recent one. I think they had a 2-0 lead in the third period against the Sabres and then wound up losing that one. But yeah, they're kind of hanging around.
Yeah.
But still, I think it's pretty tough to be excited about the direction of the team right now.
Okay, in terms of, because they do still have a lot of like theoretically interesting young players, right? I mean, obviously Leo Carlson, super high draft pick a couple of years ago. Mason McTavish,
your guy Trevor Zegras not going to be playing tonight.
My guy Trevor Zegras, sure, that's me. Minchukov, right? Like you go down the list, who should be exciting for fans to tune in and watch tonight on the Ducks? Like if you had to zero in on one guy who's like, okay, yeah, it's Greg Cronin and all that, and it's annoying in a lot of ways, but this guy can
and
still
why
be
is it
a,
Brian
fun, a fun viewing experience. Brian Dumoulin.
Brian Dumoulin, so good. I mean, it should be guys like Minchukov and Zellweger, although because of the additions they made on the blue line, bringing in Trouba and Dumoulin, those guys have been kind of rotating as healthy scratches and not actually playing.
Yeah, I think Zellweger's a scratch
should.
Tonight.
Yeah. It's really tough to justify, in my opinion, to keep doing that. It's still Troy Terry, and just in terms of he's a bit older than those guys, but in terms of just like talent and the way he plays, it's so beautiful stylistically. So I'd say him. Leo Carlson is clearly the one that you're gonna have your eyes on in terms of development, because I feel like they need him to hit as a legitimate top flight center for this to come together. Mason McTavish has been playing much better recently. He started the year incredibly poorly. Greg Cronin publicly called him a third liner, which I've never seen someone do for a former third overall pick like that. And then he, just despite him seemingly, started scoring a bunch of goals. So we love to see that. But yeah, there's some fun young players. They've been playing better. But ultimately, in terms of the style as well, right? They're the worst defensive team in the league. Not in terms of goals against, because both their goalies have been incredible, but in terms of what they give up. And so the opportunities are going to be there for the Canucks. If there's anyone to play against that's going to give them an opportunity to get the 30 shots on goal, it will be this Ducks team.
Come on, let's go. Let's do it tonight, guys.
I mean, let's go for 20 and 25 first to start before
yeah,
we
baby
start.
Baby steps.
Ambitiously saying 30.
Yeah, 24 and a half. If I set the line 24 and a half, you betting the over?
Yeah, because it's really, really hard
I
to do
think
so
I
against
would.
This Ducks.
Yeah, I think I mean, would take the over. With Quinn Hughes back in the lineup, I think I would take the over.
And the last time they played them, they went off offensively, right?
It was 5-1, yeah.
Yes.
Mash the under. Mash it.
if you go under 24 shots on goal or 25 shots on goal against this Ducks team, that's a whole new low.
If anyone can do it, it's this iteration of the Vancouver Canucks.
That's true.
Jim, we were debating this a little bit on the show, and then the wake of him having a really strong game, I'm curious to put it to you. Is Connor Garland a first-line forward?
Ideally, no. I mean, I think he could be in the right situation in terms of just pure 5-on-5 impact. I know he scored the power play goal last night, but not necessarily someone that you're going to be using in that sort of traditional top-line forward role where they're also driving your top unit power play. But I think over the past, you know, especially last year, the 5-on-5 impact he had and his ability to drive play with Dakota Joshua, even though they weren't being viewed as such, was essentially the team's top 5-on-5 line. So yeah, I on this team, maybe. On a legitimate Stanley Cup contender, probably not. But I still think a really good player nonetheless, obviously.
With, generally speaking, just sort of what you're seeing from the Canucks, the Flames, and Utah, how would you handicap the state of this race? And do you think Dom's 78% Canucks to make the playoffs odds needs to be looked at askance?
You're not even going to include the Ducks there in today's
absolutely not
pivotal matchup? The Blues are
a four-pointer,
well.
A big
yes,
four-pointer.
Big four-pointer.
No, I barely am including the Flames.
Curious to see if Greg Cronin, to your point, in the Utah game, if it's tied late, if he pulls the goalie trying to get that 4-point swing. I think the Flames have been underrated all year. I think Dom bumped them up recently, but as recently as a couple days ago, he still had them at like 11% to make it, yep, even though they were at the time sitting in a playoff spot with only 25 games left. So I think just by nature of that, they should probably be closer to 50%, honestly. I think we're in agreement that Utah has the highest upside in terms of disrupting this race and leapfrogging the Canucks, just because they're finally getting healthy on the blue line. A lot of their young players figure to get better down the stretch, and they have some offensive juice and rush upside that the teams they're competing with don't really have. They're also a young team that takes so many penalties, has blown so many one-goal games this year, and so it feels like it's still probably a year away from them, and the Canucks are going to benefit from that, I think. But I think just looking at the way the teams have played this year, it should be much closer as a three-horse race between those teams. And I think the reason, as I'm sure Tom's spoken about plenty on the show, the reason why Dom's model has them at 78% or whatever is because his model incorporates previous seasons. And obviously the Canucks, based on last year, trend much higher than those two teams. But based on this year alone, I feel like it should be pretty even between.
Yeah, I mean, the model is still like expecting old Elias Pettersson to walk through that door at some point, right? Yeah. And it's, I don't think that's going to happen at this point. Have we talked to you about Elias Pettersson at any point, by the way? I feel like you're like the only person at the station
times,
who
yeah,
hasn't had to weigh in. But like,
yeah,
I guess, is it as painful for you to watch as it is for everyone else right now?
It is. It is, because it's, I mean, I don't want to say it's inexplicable, because I think it can be explained by the fact that he's clearly not 100% mm-hmm. as referenced by his skating speed being down, his unwillingness to shoot the puck, him being in these situations where he does have a chance. I think he had like a couple in Utah as well where it's like he's in a spot to do something with it, and when he's at his best and he's feeling his game, he's going to make you pay for it, and it just squanders the opportunity. And so I think it's incredibly frustrating. I don't know. I don't really have too much more to add to the conversation, honestly. I wouldn't expect it at this point to change. Like, I think he clearly needs a full offseason of rehabbing and getting what he didn't have the luxury of last offseason, which is like just getting into proper game shape and being all systems go heading into the season. It's tough to do that within the grind of an NHL season, especially having played for Team Sweden and Four Nations and not even getting that break in between. So I wouldn't expect anything to change. But at this point, the bar to clear is so low for him to improve his contribution that like I'm still... maybe I'm delusional, but I'm still holding out hope that it's going to get better, even though there's really been no signs to point to that it will.
I think it has to get better. I know saying that is like famous last words. It can't, like, the idea that he's going to play the rest of his career at this level is just like inconceivable.
He has one goal this season outside the second period. Did I see that stat on the broadcast? He has 11 goals, I think. 10 of them have been
in the second period,
and then he has one in either the first
there's
or
a lot
period.
Of wild stats. There's a lot of wild stats. Yeah. The question for me is just like, how much better does it get? But anyways, so with this version of Elias Pettersson in the lineup, and we were just talking about it, how much the Canucks have struggled to get scoring chances, shots, goals, whatever. Now, Quinn Hughes coming back will help that.
Yep.
We get a lot of texts on our show angry at Rick Tocchet and the way he is coaching his team. But I also look at the lineup, and it was especially obvious when Quinn Hughes was out. There's not a lot of guys that move the needle offensively. Do you see tweaks the Canucks should be making to try to juice offense? Or is it a simple fact of like, yeah, they don't really have the horses to be much more than this right now?
I don't really think they have the horses. I think they have to almost play this kind of low event, grinded out style.
Yeah.
Increase the variance in terms of just less stuff happening and hoping to kind of gut out low scoring victories. That's probably the way they have to play. I will say, like, especially even, you know, the chances in that game were so few and far between, but Filip Hedl once again looked phenomenal and came so close to scoring that goal at the end of regulation. And he's actually creating off the rush. And it's almost like it's such a breath of fresh air on this team.
It looks
like
totally different than anything else they were running out. It's like, whoa,
this looks like the Four Nations. And then all of a sudden everyone else, and it's like, all right, we're back to dumping the puck out and living a fight another day. And so, yeah, that's been a very pleasant surprise to see early on in his Canucks tenure. So I think that would be a reason for optimism in terms of just more of that and that line continuing to hopefully turn some of those chances into goals. But beyond that, it probably is more of the same.
What have your thoughts been on Hronek, especially in the games that Quinn Hughes missed? Have you taken these games as an indication of like what he can do as sort of standalone driver, or has it reinforced maybe a view that he's a supporting piece best used?
It's tough to say. I mean, the volume obviously while he was there was immensely high for him, and that's just an entirely different set of challenges to evaluate him under. I think encouraging. I think probably for this team to reach its full capability, and maybe not even this season, but hopefully heading into next season, it probably will be him driving or at least playing sort of a 1A, 1B role on a second pair, because Quinn Hughes is so dominant himself and so puck dominant that you're going to be able to make it work pretty much with anyone with him. So I'd say that's probably best case scenario. So in terms of kind of trying that out and giving him more runway to develop, that was probably one of the silver linings. But yeah, it's something that I think they're certainly going to have to figure out. I don't know. What do you guys think in terms of what you saw?
I liked it a lot, to be honest. And I've been much more interested than Drance in seeing Hronek on his own pair. And I get it. Like, him and Hughes have been phenomenal together. Yeah. And I do wonder if going into next season, when maybe you have more options on the blue line, it's something they can consider, because you're right. Like, he just doesn't get a chance to do some of the stuff he was doing in Hughes's absence when he's with Hughes. And I was like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. I like what I'm seeing here. Yeah. And I think as the guy on a second pair, like with a Marcus Pettersson who's so reliable defensively, that's pretty interesting to me.
See, I thought the limitations showed pretty significantly. Shot selection is not top line or top pair offensive driver quality. I also thought he struggled defensively, especially last night. I thought last night, now Hughes was back,
but
he played a lot without Hughes, and I thought the seams showed incredibly in those minutes. Like, in some ways, I thought his game in Utah was good, his game in Vegas was poor, and then last night, it's like with Hughes on the ice, I sort of felt like I saw both. And the minute with Hughes versus without, I think are very, very evident. Like, it's a powerful factor in how effective he looks to my eyes anyway.
Well, I'm sure you guys spoke about this before I came on, but Jim Hiller probably should have been the first star for the Canucks last night. His decision after what he saw in the third period against Vegas, where they just skated laps around the Golden Knights with that line with Kempe, with Byfield and Fiala, to be like, no, we're going to go back to what we've been doing all year, which is incredibly pedestrian offensive hockey. And then going down 2-0 after having only 12 shots in the first 40 minutes, and then being like, all right, fine, I guess I'll put my three best players together again. And then immediately creating a goal and a bunch of rush chances is mind-boggling. So I feel like he really, really did the Canucks a massive favor in that game last night.
Yeah, that was pretty nice of him. I also, by the way, had this thought of, as you made the reference to like Filip Hedl looking like the Four Nations, imagine like a hockey fan or a non-hockey fan in LA who got hyped up by the Four Nations.
Yeah.
And it was like, I gotta check out this NHL. And then the first two periods of that game, you're like, what the heck? This is a different sport.
Well, and there weren't fans in the building. Like, if the Kings played hockey the way they did in the third, which I think they have the pieces even to do it. You know, like that line, you need to see that line play 20 games if you're the Kings, because, you know, if you're going to overcome the built to lose to the Oilers in six allegations, like the level of juice that that line's able to bring to the table feels like a straightforward path to doing it. They need to see if that works, not just to be a break glass in case of emergency comeback option, but an option to durably help them build leads so they can lean on what they do well to close out games.
Yeah, but I mean, the ambitions of that organization are, you know, for all the frustrations of the Canucks and Rick Tocchet and the way they want to play, like the Kings are very similar, have more horses to do so, and that maybe makes it even more frustrating that they choose to do it that way, but it's like they just want to do the bare minimum offensively to get by. So, and you saw that last night.
Look, I love doing the bare minimum, all right? So I can relate to the Kings, but maybe not the best way to go about trying to win a Stanley Cup. I wanted to ask you about Brock Besser. Now, we'll see. He could still end up remaining with the Vancouver Canucks beyond the deadline and maybe even sign an extension with them. It feels like it's trending more towards a trade. Do you see a good fit, a potential fit around the NHL that you think, okay, that's a team that would be smart to go out and bid on Brock Besser's services?
Yeah, I mean, a bunch of teams, just a right-handed finisher like that who, even if he's not the 20% shooter he was last year when he scored 40 goals, still this year he's about 17%, I think 14% for his career. Clearly an above-average finisher with some efficiency to his game. I think Tampa Bay makes a lot of sense. Not that they have a bunch of assets or even cap space for this year, but I think if he hits the market, because they're one of these few teams that the cap's going up, right?
Yes.
But they have everyone on their team signed already, so they're just going to add $7.5 million of free space for them to work with. I think a right shot for them would make a lot of sense. I think in season right now in New Jersey would make a lot of sense, because you're watching and guys like 34-year-old Andre Palat and Thomas Tatar are playing top 6 minutes and really letting down their top two centers, so they'd be a fit. Minnesota's in perpetuity going to be linked to Brock Besser, I think, until he either goes there or signs somewhere else long term. Pretty much every contender, I feel like, could use Brock Besser, including the Vancouver Canucks. I feel like they desperately need Brock Besser. They're 32nd in the league in slot shots. I feel like they need more Brock Besser.
Yeah, but do they need him more than whatever they're getting in return for him is the thing.
Well, the issue is that while the market should be hot in terms of, I just said a lot of teams need him and would desire him, we typically don't see rental wingers command a lot of the market, right? Like, Tyler Toffoli last year, when he went from New Jersey to Winnipeg, fetched a second and a fourth or a second and a third in return. Like, you might get a late first, potentially, but you're not going to see a premium young player or any sort of top pick moved. And so I feel like the market for that type of player prototype isn't going to move the needle one way or another. You might be able to get a couple of futures that you can then pivot and turn into a player that fits the timeline better, but I feel like you should temper expectations in terms of what a rental winger is going to get back in return.
I just think if they had like five more points in the standings and were like legit in the mix for third in the Pacific or something, it's like then I could be maybe be talked into keeping past the deadline, but it's like, man, you might not even make the playoffs. Like, if Dustin Wolf gets super hot, you might not make the playoffs. And so that's a tough one to swallow if you hold him and miss the playoffs.
True. But teams love holding on to their guys and then being like, well, this is our rental acquisition. This guy is our rental.
They do love that. Yeah.
And so I could see that as well. I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, I think certainly, and you talk about, you know, from Besser's perspective, there's been a lot of talk about like, all right, well, if he signed the Canucks, would he take a hometown discount or what have you? You look at the market this year and how the UFA pool is so devoid of like legitimate scorers, especially guys who aren't in their 30s yet, and so Besser is probably just salivating at the idea of what he could get from one of these teams, especially with the cap going up and all of a sudden a bunch of teams having an extra $5-6 million to work with.
What about recreating the JT Miller dynamic if the Canucks do deal Besser, right? Because as you note, there are rental wingers available at reasonable cost. So even if it is a second and a fourth, or let's say a late first and another asset, whether it's a prospect or a player, you know, take the pick you get, bundle it for, you know, or not even the pick you get, maybe a lesser pick, but bundle it for like a Zucker or a Tanev, you know, not as good a player, but at least a guy that maybe can bring some speed and give you some reinforcements. Because the Canucks, let's be real, they're not just short top line players and top six players, but they, you know, they don't even have like a 12th forward I mean, we're debating whether they'll go 11-7 tonight or not. And it's like, well, why wouldn't you really? There's a 12th forward that's demanding inclusion at the moment.
True.
But yeah, I wonder what would you think if the Canucks executed something like that with Besser ahead of the deadline?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, Sucker would be interesting because he does have more speed. I think the Tanev idea would not move me at all because it's like, wow, we're going to get even worse offensively. I don't know. I think there's some interesting, I'm curious to see what like Seattle does, for example, right? Because I'm going to dreamcast a lot of, or wishcast a lot of Jared McCann trades.
Loved the dreamcast back in the day.
The dreamcast. I'm dreaming right now about Jared McCann going to all sorts of different contenders. But like a guy like Oliver Bjorkstrand, right? Who,
yeah.
His cap hit is very reasonable. It's around the 4-5 range. He's got another year after this one. He's a very good player. Like if you went that route, I think that would be interesting. But I imagine if the Canucks move on from Besser, they also probably are doing so with the idea of creating flexibility in the offseason and not tying themselves to another contract. So maybe that kind of takes a move like that out of contention.
I think they'd do it for the right player, potentially. I don't know if Bjorkstrand is that player, but I think they know they need a replacement. If you can get one who's signed for next year, I think there'd at least be some interest in that. We haven't brought up Seattle until you did just there. They do play them over the weekend. It's the Canucks' next opponent after Anaheim. I kind of just feel like they might be the most bland team in the NHL. Like they've just fallen from, oh, excitement, new franchise, and then that one playoff moment where they beat Colorado. And they've just been off the radar so completely since then, it seems like. I mean, is there anything interesting, exciting going on or on the horizon with the Seattle Kraken?
Yeah, I feel like they stumbled upon something with the Kako acquisition. I feel like he's gotten Matty Beniers to playing more like the level offensively we were hoping to see from him. That line with Kako, Beniers, and Jaden Schwartz has been quite good since they put them together. So at least that's something. Those are the types of moves that Seattle clearly should be trying to make more of moving forward, just getting sort of younger, high upside forwards to add to the mix as opposed to the way they've operated the past couple of years. So, yeah, I would say that has sort of differentiated them a little bit here. But, I mean, ultimately, you watch their most recent game against St. Louis where they just got completely blown out by a Blues team I'm highly skeptical of. So, yeah, there's not that much there to be holding on to, but they're going to be a heavy player in terms of sellers, right? Whether it's McCann or Bjorkstrand or Yanni Gord, even though he's out right now, Jamie Oleksiak. Like, they could be, Tanev. They could be involved in all sorts of stuff. So I feel like at least for Kraken fans, that provides a level of excitement in terms of just being involved in the storyline.
Nothing more exciting than being a big seller at the deadline.
Tanev, I honestly, he's a guy I've been really keeping my eye on from a Canucks perspective because we know what Jim Rutherford and company think of Brandon Tanev. But I also wonder about Winnipeg, the team he originally signed for, in part because his brother Chris advised him not to sign in Vancouver. But the Jets need for speed, man. I mean, he's not the second line center they'd ideally get, but as a luxury item add, I feel like that makes a ton of sense too. What quick thoughts on that before we go?
They gotta aim higher. I mean, we've talked about how this is the year for the Jets. Probably no team has more on the line in terms of how good they are, the cap going up, and how that sort of handcuffs them against other contenders moving forward. So if the move for them was Brandon Tanev, I'd be pretty disappointed. I feel like they need to be going for a massive home run hit, and that's clearly not that.
Dim, always appreciate the time, man. Thanks for coming on with us on a Thursday. He is Dmitry Filipovich. You can hear, of course, him on the Hockey PDO cast right here on Sportsnet 650 and the Sportsnet Radio Network. We will take a break. Up next, we'll go around the NHL with John Mattis from The Score here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. How would you kind of describe this Ducks team this year? Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are live from the Kintec Studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650
650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in now. John Mattis from The Score is going to join us here in just a moment. Canucks game day again today. They play the Anaheim Ducks. And by the way, I just wanted to mention this as well for the listeners. A week from tomorrow, a week from Friday, is the NHL trade deadline. And as part of wall-to-wall coverage here on Sportsnet 650, our schedule changes a little bit. We'll be on at 10 and going for an extra hour. So 10 to 1 on the station. So right as the deadline ends at, or a deadline passes at noon, we'll be on the air to break it down. And always a pleasure to be on the air for those big shows, Drancer. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I'm on a 4-year streak of being the first to report that the Canucks are done for the day.
Will it last? Can he keep it going?
I don't break much.
You stay in your lane. I love it. We'll see. That's the tease for everyone to tune in. Can Drance continue his streak of being the first with Canucks are done for the day tweet? We'll see. All right, now joining us, we can look ahead to the deadline. We can chat about everything else going on in the NHL right now. From The Score covering the NHL, he is John Mattis. John, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good, guys. Maybe I'm missing something because you guys probably film your show, but what just happened there with that pause?
Oh, well, Drance is on location right now. So they're he's in Anaheim covering, or in Southern California, to cover the Canucks down there tonight. So there's some technical stuff going on. We'll see. We fight through it, though. We make it work.
I wasn't sure if I missed an inside joke or something and I popped in at the wrong time.
No, it's all good. So as I mentioned, Canucks, you know, down in Anaheim tonight, they picked up a desperately needed 2 points against the LA Kings last night, and it wasn't pretty. They blow a 2-goal third period lead, but they get the job done ultimately in overtime. And it's been such a weird season for the Canucks, obviously, with the Elias Pettersson drop off, the JT Miller drama, and eventual trade. Then they get in some interesting new players after the Miller deal. Then Quinn Hughes is out and he finally makes his return. They've struggled to score recently, but they're still right there in the playoff fight with the Calgary Flames. What's your kind of big picture perspective on the Canucks team as it's currently set up and their prospects for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of struggling with how to view the Canucks right now, especially with the deadline nearing, in terms of, okay, like, do they see this season as, not necessarily they're giving up on it, but hey, let's kind of hold the line here and regroup in the summer versus getting caught up in the moment and trying to patch over some serious holes and some serious problems. Because, and I don't know if it's all downstream from the JT Miller, Elias Pettersson drama, but the offense is a disaster. I mean, yeah. I'm sure you guys know it all and well, but like, I just looked it up on SportLogic. They have 13.1 quality scoring chances per game, the Canucks. The only other teams with worse numbers in that category, the Ducks, the Kraken, the Blackhawks, the Sharks. I mean, the Canucks are in a playoff spot somehow, but they seem to almost be backing into it, and it's more of a matter of who's behind them not catching up versus them being this team that absolutely deserves to be in the playoffs. And obviously, you know, not having Hughes is a huge factor, and, you know, what's going on with Brock Besser? Has this become a matter of distraction with him being a pending UFA? You know, the Lankinen extension, what does that mean for Demko and Seelovs and what's going on in the crease? So I feel like it's almost like this team is allergic to normalcy or calm or just like a week of no drama. And it's all sort of snowballed. I don't know. It just, from afar, it seems like it's one of those seasons that everywhere you look around every corner, there's a new storyline for people to jump on. And it's, you know, it's not only that, but it's like, if you just watch this team strictly on the ice, there's a clear problem with the offense. And, you know, speaking of storylines, correct me if I'm wrong, but Rick Tocchet isn't signed through next season. So, yeah, they're one of those teams across the league where you go, obviously it's positive you make the playoffs. You know, you don't want to tank a season. But, you know, if you're management, does half your mind go to the off season? Does it go to, like, how do I fix this thing when things settle down versus trying to power through it here in the lead up to the deadline?
Yeah, and I do wonder if one kind of, I don't want to call it a silver lining because ultimately it doesn't actually matter that much, but one knock-on effect of this Canucks season is I wonder if people around the league have started to really realize just how valuable Quinn Hughes is as a player. Because, you know, I think in past, even last season, right, he got lumped in with, wow, you know, the trio of great Canucks players, Hughes, Pettersson, Miller, right? And Demko was so good. So he had to fourth as a goalie. And this year, you know, obviously Pettersson's a shadow of himself. Miller's gone now and he wasn't performing up to his standard. Demko's been injured most of the season. And you look, and all of a sudden, Quinn Hughes, 60 points in 48 games. That's 24 ahead of the next closest teammate, which is Connor Garland. And Connor Garland's played 10 more games. And I wonder if it's just kind of put into context for everyone around the NHL when you see like that stat in particular, just how much this guy is doing for his team night in, night out.
Yeah, I think it's non-controversial to say that he's brought himself to the Cale Makar tier of NHL defensemen, and it becomes more of a two-headed monster in terms of this generation. And, you know, obviously Hughes was right there with Makar before this season, but the fact that he's carried this team on his back, you mentioned the big gap in points. I mean, the on and off numbers are wild in terms of attempts, scoring chances, expected goals. Basically, last time I checked, I mean, this might be a little old now, but last time I checked, it was basically like the Canucks are, you know, a contender-like team when he's on the ice, and they're a lottery team when he's off the ice. Like, he's been that much of an MVP. And, you know, we talked about the quality chances or the lack thereof them with the Canucks team this year. Well, if you take Hughes off the roster, I mean, how dire would it be out there, right? So, and it's also, you got to factor in like the human element of this, where during this whole Miller Pettersson saga, like presumably Hughes was kind of caught in the middle of it as the captain. So props to him that he's somehow been able to push that aside and put together the best season of his career. And it's unfortunate that he's injured right now, because the Canucks surely need him.
With the Canucks, the Utah Hockey Club, the Flames, how do you sort of handicap this race? What are your expectations at this point?
Oh, it's tough, because I feel like Calgary's been like, for the first half of the season, I was like, okay, this team's gonna go away. This team's gonna come back to earth, because I don't know about you guys, but I had the Flames as a bottom five team, maybe bottom three team coming in the season. So, you know, you wait for that shoe to drop, but it just hasn't. I mean, mind you, they're still a negative 14 goal differential team. It's not like they've been killing it, but I feel like they've hung around long enough that they deserve some credit. And realistically, even though they are, this might seem counterintuitive, even though they're quote unquote rebuilding, or, you know, aggressive retooling, whatever you want to call it, I feel like the playoffs mean a lot to that organization as far as Craig Conroy and his vision of staying somewhat competitive while they continue to build this team up and build the core up. So the motivation is certainly there. They obviously have a game in hand on Vancouver. As for Utah, I mean, they have an issue with discipline and keeping themselves out of the box. They've had major injuries to their blue line. I feel like if you're comparing on paper the Flames to Utah in terms of true talent, and if both teams are firing on all cylinders, I would take Utah every day of the week. I think that they've assembled something pretty special in that top six. And they've got enough depth over in and around the roster to compete. So honestly, like, I don't know about like the handicap. I would say, honestly, I would give Utah the edge. I know that they have more games played than Vancouver and Calgary at this point and are 4 points back, but there's something about that roster and Bill Armstrong having all this cap space and them being this new club with a ton of money where they can maybe make some noise at the deadline. I feel like we haven't seen the best of Utah, and there's enough runway here that they can make up that ground. Whereas, you know, Vancouver, do they continue to sort of spiral a little bit here? Does Calgary finally fall off again? I don't know if that's the case. I think that they've proven that they won't, but for some reason, Utah's giving me the vibes that they will be the team that beats out Vancouver and Calgary.
With Utah, you mentioned sort of the opportunity. I mean, this team has been built so slowly. It's been slow cooked, mostly for resource starvation reasons down in the desert. And obviously their circumstance is new, but how would you think about them accelerating versus the thought process of, you know, continuing to build with their eye toward striking it bigger, maybe going forward? How do you think they should balance that?
Yeah. I mean, it's always a balance. And I just think that, they've stockpiled enough. Like, it's been enough of let's slow play this. And Logan Cooley, Clayton Keller, Dylan Gunther, Nick Schmaltz. I mean, their guns are here. I wouldn't say that they're fully insulated to be some sort of cup contender, but if they, for example, use Lawson Crouse as a trade chip, and you know, attach a pick to it or whatever, they could get in the sweepstakes for one of the bigger pending UFAs of the deadline. Or do they get involved in, I don't know, I'm just throwing a random name out there, but like a Dylan Cousins, where it's a bit of a short and long-term play. I don't know. I just feel like they're highly motivated. And we saw it in the summer with Sergachev, right? This is an organization early in its tenure in Salt Lake City that isn't messing around. And, you know, I think that, you know, similar to Calgary, again, to go back to them, like I feel like the playoffs might mean something more to Utah and Calgary than it does to Vancouver, given the way that all three seasons have gone. And that Bill Armstrong, with obviously he's got to get the blessing of ownership, but he can get to work here. I mean, if you loop in those Arizona years, it's when have they ever had a chance to do something? And I'm not saying they have to be reckless or have to do something outlandish or something or whatever, but for them to be buyers is a step in the right direction. And I would assume they're headed there, assuming that, you know, the next few games, the next week or so, doesn't go too poorly.
Looking up the Western Conference standings a little bit, the Edmonton Oilers, I mean, I've had them as the Stanley Cup favorite for most of the season. Now, they've lost four in a row going back to the game before the Four Nations break. And coming out of the break, right, it's 6-3 to Philly, 7-3 to Washington, 4-1 loss against Tampa. And then they've got a rematch with the Florida Panthers in Florida tonight from the Stanley Cup final. Is this cause for legitimate concern? Have you downgraded your the chances you're giving the Oilers of winning the cup this year, or is this just kind of a post Four Nations hangover that they'll snap out of?
I'd say it's closer to a hangover than anything. I think once you have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl in their prime, and Draisaitl having the best season of his career, I think that there's no way you can count them out. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it seems like the league's become more star-centric or more, how do you put it, like stars can kind of impact each game a little more easily. Is that the right word? A little easier. Easier is the word than they used to in the past. And I just feel like if you have those two trump cards of Draisaitl and McDavid, your ceiling is automatically super high. And obviously they've, over the years, built a strong enough nucleus to surround them that, you know, on the right night, they can go nuclear and kind of go off on any given team. And I don't know. I know that they need to upgrade at forward. I know they need to upgrade at defense. But for some reason, like I'm in my head, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be fantastic if they went for some sort of home run swing with a goalie at the deadline? And that's to put nothing against, you know, Skinner. He actually has a positive goal saved above expected rate this year, according to SportLogic. But you know, is there a way to get creative and bolster that position? And you know, the St. Louis Blues are obviously a very interesting team right now as far as how available are their players, Braden Schenn, Colin Parayko, Jordan Binnington. I mean, does Binnington end up in Edmonton? Just throwing it out there, and total, it's 100% speculation, but I just think that would be really fun if we saw the Oilers, not that they haven't been all in previously, but if they really sort of doubled down on solidifying their goaltending and having a 1-2 punch of Skinner and Binnington versus Skinner and Pickard and seeing where that takes them.
Speaking of the trade deadline, and you mentioned, you know, you'd like to see Edmonton get really aggressive at this deadline. Which other teams do you think should be very, very motivated to push and try to improve their team ahead of next Friday?
I'm kind of, you know, maybe it's just the flavor of the day kind of thing, but I'm kind of leaning towards keeping a close eye on Detroit. I feel like, you know, whether it's lightning in the bottle, new coach bump, whatever, since the coaching change, they've been virtually unbeatable. And although Steve Yzerman has made some fumbles in the free agent market previously, especially on defense, he's been relatively calm, relatively conservative during this rebuild. And hey, it's been 8 years since they made the playoffs. They're having their hottest stretch right before the deadline. Andrew Kopp goes out, so there's potential. You know, he's out for the season, so there is a ton of cap space there with LTIR. You know, do they become the aggressor or one of the aggressors ahead of the deadline? I don't know if it would be like super smart to put all your eggs in one basket for this season, but if there's a way for them to get the best of both worlds, where they, you know, trade out a Tarasenko that hasn't worked out super well, but then bring in more of a long-term piece and then another long-term piece that works now. Like, kind of just shuffle the deck a little bit more since they have the flexibility with the cap. I think that'd be super interesting. And, you know, let's face it, the league's a better place if an original six team like Detroit is making noise and just not just kind of sputtering along, which I feel like they've been doing for the last half decade or so.
It's interesting. It's an off-the-board one. I like it, John. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Have a good one.
That is John Mattis from The Score joining us here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, and looking ahead to the trade deadline a little bit. I like that the Jordan Binnington to Edmonton idea. Reunite the McDavid-Binnington combo from the Four Nations. Maybe you get the Binnington-Hellebuck matchup, Edmonton-Winnipeg in the Western Conference Finals.
Just do something. You can't go into this playoff with Skinner and Picker. That's insane.
Yeah.
I know all the talk is that they're not going to do it, but, like, that makes no sense. Like, we don't have to accept the terms that that's okay.
Don't you think teams are just permanently spooked by the midseason goalie thing, though? The deadline goalie trade?
But we're talking about upgrading on Calvin Pickard, man.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not saying they need to dump Stuart Skinner or, you know, push in chips for John Gibson or, you know, fire some guy with, like, lots of money in term. Am I okay?
Yeah, we got you. I mean, I can't speak to you being okay, but we can hear you and see you. Don't worry.
yeah, I mean, I'm not saying they should do that. But they should absolutely upgrade at least the backup position, upgrade the platoon as a whole.
Yeah, it seems like the low-hanging fruit, certainly, for them. Although, I mean, I think there's major questions you could ask of their blue line at the moment as well, and some places to improve that. So we'll see. I mean, I think what John said there is basically spot on, which is, look, they have Connor McDavid. They have Leon Draisaitl. They're going to be an absolute monster to deal with in the playoffs pretty much no matter what. But there are also some obvious areas for them to try to improve. As well ahead of the deadline. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And, you know, just looking ahead to the deadline a little bit, obviously we have talked at length about the Brock Besser situation, and it seems to be trending towards a trade, but that's very much up in the air and could go either way. Do you have a sense of beyond Besser? You know, we're 8 days out now. I feel like we haven't heard a lot of reporting one way or another on the Canucks' plans, the Canucks' kind of stance and their intentions. And I guess partly that could be because it's fluid and there's a lot of different things they could do. But do you have kind of a sense of where the Canucks stand going into the deadline other than on Brock Besser?
Well, I think the main reason you don't have a ton of concrete info is that it is a moving target.
Yeah.
And I think the performance of the actual team, like, this is a tough one, right? The gambling odds, you opened minus 175, but you're only narrowly favored tonight against a Ducks team that has been materially better than you across the last 25 games, that has good goaltending, that is going to be the more rested side. You lose tonight, you lose in Seattle. The way forward is going to be much clearer than if you come home off this road trip having won three in a row after, like, a tough back-to-back to start it. So I do think that what we see here across even just the balance of this road trip is going to be pretty critical in terms of shaping what this team does and how willing they are to keep their own guys and, you know, how aggressive they may get in sort of looking not too far ahead. Like, I know one thing we're not going to see is this team wave the white flag, but, you know, the own rental thing is really just like a hockey way of factoring in opportunity cost.
Yeah.
Right? You're paying for the players that you keep. You really are. It's just that you're paying by not accepting a return. And so I do think the club will be careful about that, in part because we've seen Rutherford and Alvin be careful about that, even in seasons in which they were, you know, on the outside looking in, but not that far away. The Boudreaux bump season, this market was talking playoffs, and they still were willing to trade Tyler. Like, they still were willing to look further afield and sort of supplement their roster with, like, Brad Richards claims and on and on, rather than, you know, pushing chips into the center of the table. I just don't think there's any honest way of looking at where this team is at where Pettersson's game is at, where Hughes's health is at, where Demko's health is, right? And concluding that this is a season in which the team should incur opportunity cost. You know, you can't do it. So I think they know that. Like, fundamentally, I think they know that. But the classic characteristics of this team, right? They're the will of ownership to win is how Lawrence Gilman described it. I heard Lawrence Gilman describe it today, and I think that's a tactful way of saying, you know, the congenital impatience or verging on short-sightedness that the Canucks have shown over the years. Like, I still think that's going to govern how they approach this, but it seems to me that a hybrid approach very much in line with what they've already done, selling JT Miller as a classic, you know, seller-type deal, but then taking one of the assets to buy a couple guys and then extending those guys.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's still a way forward, right? If you can't come to terms with Besser, can you net a big return for Besser and come to terms on, you know, something like 3 years at $4 million with Jason Zucker, right? Like, is that something that, or you know, pick X winger who's not as good as Besser but might be more affordable and involve a shorter term commitment, right? Like, is that the sort of thing that this team can find for, you know, in terms of what they're going to do? I still think results are going to matter over the near term, but in terms of what I think just the sort of facts on the ground are pointing to, I do think creativity, finding a way to do both, being a hybrid buyer seller, that's the way forward here.
Yeah, and I think the key there, we'll take a break in just a second here, but the key there is if it has value beyond just this year. My appetite for just flipping some Besser assets for a straight rental, but you still keep some of the assets, I don't have a lot of appetite for that. If it's someone you think is a fit for next year and beyond, okay, then that's one. That's a different story, as we saw with Marcus Pettersson and Drew O'Connor. Denny's True North taste awaits with Denny's 100% Canadian beef burgers made with new shredded iceberg lettuce on a brioche bun and all the classic ingredients you love. We will take a break here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in. Open segment to wrap up the show here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Canucks and Ducks.
We've got the game tonight at 7. On your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
To Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows of these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at rogers.com. Some texts coming in. Trade deadline look ahead, trade deadline questions, all of that, building off our conversation to end that last segment, Drancer. And this one from an unsigned texter: can you please explain to me why the Canucks would not consider someone like Braden Schenn? He's one, he's a veteran voice, he's a legit top six center, and he is a physical force. Plus, his brother Luke, of course, already had a great impact on Quinn. And there is report, or there are reports out there, I know Nick Kiprios and others, that the Blues are open for business. They're interested in, you know, whether it's Binnington or Parayko or Braden Schenn. Some of those guys could be on the move. I think there's a lot of reasons why a player like Braden Schenn would be interesting for the Canucks, but also a lot of reasons why you would be wary, right? Starting with his age, signed until 2028. Does he really, like, we're talking about a team that needs a lot more dangerous up attacking upside. Does he really bring that at this stage of his career? But I think the texter also makes a really good point about just the type of person he is, how well Luke Schenn fit in here, all of the different things that Braden Schenn brings. I think the other aspect to consider, of course, is Braden Schenn controls this process. He's got the full no trade clause. This is a guy who's won a cup, a very proud competitive player. If he's on the move, if he's willing to sign off on a deal, does it have to be to a team with a legitimate chance at the Stanley Cup this year? But it's certainly one I wouldn't dismiss out of hand if there was a possibility, but it's a complicated fit, I think, to say the least.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the contract 6.5, right? Times three after this year or times two?
Times three after this year.
Times three after this year. So there's I mean, he's 33 years old, I want to say.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of years in there that you're genuinely concerned about, I think. And that's not great. But I do think just having, you know, a guy like Braden Schenn, a personality like Braden Schenn, has real value to this hockey club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think having a competitor like him, a goal scorer like him, you know, there's a lot of that stuff that I quite like. When you look at sort of where centers are paid at the moment, right? $6.5 million sort of puts you like, you know, at the end of the day, Sean Monahan just signed 5x5.5.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he was coming off very much a similar low ebb with a lengthy injury history, right? And I mean, he'd been traded with a first round pick to get out of his deal, et cetera, right? Like, Monahan was more distressed as an asset than Braden Schenn, and doesn't have some of the like intangible physical upside things that Schenn brings, even if he is 3 years younger. I don't hesitate at all to say that if Luke Schenn was a UFA this summer, you're looking at paying him more than 3x6.5, like way more, probably 7.5, 8x5 or 6 years, to be totally honest with you, right? Like, if you actually want to be the team that wins the bidding. So if you're in need of centerman, Shen's, I think, decent. He's a really good shooter still. He's a really physical player. He's a good person,
yep.
By all accounts, a great teammate. I think those are all things this team needs. And look, I don't know that you can pay through the nose for Braden Schenn, and that probably makes it a moot point, because I'm sure the Blues aren't parting with him unless you're paying through the nose. But, you know, given this team's need for centerman, I don't think we should scoff at the option at all. I think Braden Schenn would be tremendously additive to this lineup if you know, a player like him were to shake loose.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea, but as it comes down to it, as you said, the cost of acquisition. And then also just, I mean, are you a Stanley Cup contender if Braden Schenn is your second line center? Can you be a Stanley Cup contender if this version of Braden Schenn is your second line center? And probably there are other things you can do around, but you got to have like some really dynamite wingers to round things out. You know what I mean? And that's assuming that Elias Pettersson is playing at a really high first line center level. So it's one of those things where there is a lot to recommend it, but I also wonder if you're locking the guy that you're bringing in for character reasons into too important a role in your lineup at this stage of his career.
Yeah, I mean, fair. Like, his the thing, part of his game that's fallen off most, because Schenn's never been a driver, right? Schenn's never been a guy that the fancy stats especially loved. He's always been a guy who's sort of outshot what he generates, but he's been, you know, a neutral effect, complementary offensive piece. And you know, he's been a like solid enough defensive player to hold up in tough minutes. And the defensive side of the game is what's fallen off this year. But, you know, that's true for just about every Blues player you can mention. Like, that environment has not been especially impressive defensively. So I think that's partly what you're betting on, is we you know, the thing that the area that he's struggled in the most this season is the area we're best at. We're best in, so we can insulate him.
Right.
I think the issue with the fit, from my perspective, Jamie, is really more about speed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This isn't a player who upgrades Vancouver's speed down the middle, and I think that's something the club is dead set on trying to identify, if at all possible. And that ain't going to be easy, don't get me wrong. You can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. But yeah, I mean, there's also, you know, the fact that he's left-handed, and ideally this club would find a way to add a right-handed centerman, but I mean, good luck, right? There's just not a lot of those guys around, and those that are around are either, you know, those that are around and maybe available are, you know, pretty much Jean-Gabriel Pageau, who's like, you know, a tier lower, obviously, than what Luke Shen can be, right? Nick Dowd would be like the high-end option. Jake Evans from the Montreal Canadiens would be a really high-end option. And, you know, more in line, I think, with the type of player that I'd like to see the Canucks go after aggressively in trying to pull something like this out of a hat. You know, I think if you're selling Besser, if you're doing some stuff to offload but still want to buy, you know, if Evans can't get an extension done, he's a UFA, he's going to have a fair number of points this year, right? Like you're talking about a guy who's going to be in the sort of 30-point range, generally mm-hmm. speaking, or 35-point range without much power play time. And look, I mean, we really have to be honest with ourselves. Like, there's only seven right-handed centermen, primary centermen. Wyatt Johnston, Tage Thompson, Nick Suzuki, Braden Point, Mark Scheifele, Jack Eichel, and Nathan MacKinnon. So that's eight guys who are over 50 points this season. Right? Like, these guys are hard.
Pretty hard to find.
Jake Evans ranks in the top 15, right? Like, right behind Dylan Cousins and Morgan Geeky and Elias Lindholm. So, you know, for me anyway, that's a guy worth considering from a Canucks perspective. You know, I think he's a good player. So I think ultimately, what would this club be best off doing? If you're paying a premium price, I think pay the premium price for the 28-year-old.
Yes.
If you can. And so I think the Shen thing, I like the fit and I like the player more than, you know, the Jay Fresh,
the fancy stats
graph posters,
yeah,
would suggest to you. I'm not taking a shot at Jay Fresh. You know how much I love Jack's work. I'm more talking about the people who just like post the Jay Fresh chart as if that's the end of the argument, right? But I just think if you're netting assets and then sending assets out to meaningfully improve this team, I'd rather see them target an Evans or a Cousins type as opposed to, you know, the sort of guy like that Braden Shen would represent. I think Shen makes more sense, frankly, for a team that's a little bit closer to competing. A team like LA, even though they're strong down the middle, right? Like a team that mm-hmm. can use some more finishing touch to sort of put them over the edge and maybe a little bit more snarl, so which LA doesn't need, but the finishing touch side of it, I think that's the sort of team that should be after Shen. The Canucks already score goals. In some ways, they kind of need a guy to help set the table a little more, and that's kind of more in line with what Evans is capable of.
Well, you mean they have finishers, but they need guys to play, to play drive. You know what I mean? Like, because they don't score that many goals, the Canucks.
No, they don't.
Right.
But they finish.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, yeah. They can finish, they score a but lot they don't of goals get that many opportunities to finish.
Right. And so that's my point, is that, yeah. You know, my old set the table versus there's guys who helps you set the table, and there's guys who help you eat. You know, Braden Shen's a guy who helps you eat. He helps you finish off the chances you create. He's not necessarily a table setter, and I think the Canucks need more table setters, which Shen isn't. So that's sort of my issue with the fit. I'd rather see them go after a guy with more of like an Evans-type profile. And you know, if they spent significantly to land a player like that, you're not going to hear criticism from me.
I do think also, you know, we've kind of, I think post JT Miller, everyone who's looked at this has kind of thought, okay, they're going to scour the market and kind of cross their fingers and hope that a center in that, you know, 25 to 28 range comes available that they think is a long-term fit and fills some of what you're talking about. And then hopefully you have the assets to make it happen, or you win the UFA bidding or whatever the case is. And I still think that is like, that's plan one. Get a guy in that age range that you feel good about for the long term, or at least the medium term, and has some team control and all that, and you can plug him in. That's also a lot easier said than done. And I do wonder if, not even just like if that doesn't work, but even in addition, potentially, that a player with some of that classic veteran presence, winning pedigree, all of that stuff that Braden Shen brings, but maybe a guy who slots in farther down your lineup, if that's going to be a priority as well, because especially you look up front, like this is, they don't have a lot. They don't have really that guy. Like that guy, like, oh, he's been around. He's seen it all. You know what I mean? Like obviously Tyler Myers on the blue line hit 1,000 games this year, but like Teddy Bluger's their oldest regular at 30. Now he was part of the Vegas Stanley Cup winning team, although didn't play a ton in the playoffs, but there is, I can see, especially considering how this year has gone off the ice, that being a maybe not top priority, but something that we should keep our eyes open for, keep a lookout for, or at least keep on our radar going into the summer, that the Canucks are going to try to address that, maybe just at a cheaper price point than Braden Schenn would command.
Yeah, I mean, center depth for sure. There, I mean, that's top line item is center depth for sure. And in a world where they retain Tocchet, you know, which I do expect still, it's going to be center depth and center speed.
Yeah.
Like, they really feel like they need speed down the middle, I think. And, that's just true. That's just true. The best teams in this league have guys that can fly down the center of the ice.
Yeah, I wouldn't limit it to center, though. Like, they need speed. They need speed, and especially at forward.
Oh, of course. Yeah. But I think this, because of whatever has happened to Pettersson's burst, I think the need for center speed has become critical.
Glaring.
Like,
yeah.
Critical. Glaring. And I think in some ways, it's been reinforced by the dual impact of Pettersson's speed diminishing so severely and the club adding Hedl and us all watching him play and going, hey, whoa, what's this?
This is
looks
fun.
Great.
This is awesome. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Like, and you know, I mean, you know how I feel about Pew Suter. He's a player you win with, but, you know, he's not a burner, right? Like, he's not a burner. He's not a big guy, right? Like, that tweener thing that has allowed him to be affordable for Vancouver across the last 2 years and a huge part of this team's success, right? He's still not very fast. So you've got between him and Pettersson, I mean, the difference when you have Hedl on the ice right now is just, you know, feels like warp speed.
This text comes in. What are your guys' thoughts on Nick Ehlers? I really like the player. If you trade Besser at the deadline, immediately your number one UFA target is probably Nick Ehlers. It's just so hard to count on acquiring a guy in UFA, acquiring especially a player who will be as valued and as sought after as Nick Ehlers. But as I said, look, obviously not a center. He's on the wing. They need speed everywhere, and they just need, I think they need more players like Ehlers. Now there's questions of how much would Tocchet like him? Like, he's never been able to crack that kind of first line usage in Winnipeg. Would that be different here? Would it be worth what you'd have to pay to get him in unrestricted free agency? But I think if you're trying to shift to bring in more speed, more skill to this lineup, like Nick Ehlers going after him and really trying to get that done in the summer would make a ton of sense for the Canucks.
Nick Ehlers is one of my favorite players in hockey. Like, period. I think his potential has largely been untapped in Winnipeg. I think you could absolutely build a power play around him, and he's the sort of flip the ice skater that I think would fit stylistically with where this Canucks team wants to go, right?
Yeah.
I think you add a center, you pray that Pettersson gets back in form, and you add a burner with elite skill on the wing, if that's possible, right? Overpay if you've got to land an Ehlers type, man. Then I think this is pretty interesting in terms of, you know, executing a quick turnaround. What's the key, though, to pulling all that off? I do think you need to be ruthless with the decisions you make between now and the deadline. I do think you want to accumulate as much as you can, you know, and if that means that you miss the playoffs by a point or two, like, that's not what you're striving for. But I think you have to that's the risk that you can manage, right? I think the risk that you can't is the losing Besser for nothing risk. Right, I think that the risk that you can't is the caving at the 11th hour and paying Besser with a max term deal.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, those are the risks you can't manage, in my view. The risk that you can is that you narrowly miss the playoffs with a team that's likely, very likely, to get smoked in the first round anyway.
Yeah, I think my official home run going into next season plan at forward is trade Besser at the deadline. Don't flip the assets right away. Trade for a center of some description in the summer and then sign Nick Ehlers. Like, if you could pull all of that off, I think you've remade your team, obviously depending on the identity of the center and all that. You've remade your team in a potentially really interesting way going into next year. But again, it's so hard to say, like, oh, we'll just go sign player X in free agency and that will fix our team, or that will add a new dimension to our team, because it's so difficult to land guys in free agency. I did just want to take, before we get out here in a few minutes, a second. I know you mentioned it really briefly when we were talking about the game last night, but we got to give a shout out to the penalty killing units for the Canucks. And specifically, I thought Marcus Pettersson was just a defensive monster last night for the Canucks. And to the point where, like, I was thinking about it today, and I almost wanted to go back and watch his shifts and just count the number of smart plays he made with his stick at even strength on the penalty kill. And, you know, especially on that penalty kill in overtime, he was incredible. But like, man, I think it was Mike Rupp who, when he was traded to the Canucks, was like, this guy's one of the best defensive defensemen in the league. And I thought you really saw some of that element last night, where just he was disruptive all night against the Kings and the penalty killing unit as a whole. But Marcus Pettersson specifically, a monster performance, I thought, for the Canucks.
My favorite Marcus Pettersson sequence was that sequence where he tripped Adrian Kempe twice and got away with it both times. And then Kempe got frustrated and tripped him, and it drew the penalty that
you love to see
on.
It. You love to see it.
That's fantastic stuff. No, I thought his penalty killing was standout. Him and Derek Forbert, man, I think are a big reason why this team's penalty kill has trended in such a oppressive direction,
mm-hmm.
right? Over the course of the past, especially the past month, especially since Pettersson joined the team. But yeah, I mean, he looks like he could play all day. He looks like he's in the best condition of anyone on the ice most games, which is saying something when you're talking about an NHL player, right?
Yes.
He's just calm, composed. And the other thing is, you know, you're watching them play 3-on-3 last night, and usually 3-on-3 has just been this absolute nightmare for the Canucks all season, in part because, especially in those 6 weeks that Hronek missed, right? It was like the moment Quinn Hughes left the ice, you kind of knew that the Canucks were cooked and going to give up a goal against the other way. Now, having both Hronek and Hughes in the lineup obviously changes that dynamic, but and I don't even think Pettersson got to it because of the fact that the Canucks ended up taking the, like, not in 3-on-3 activity anyway, because the Canucks ended up taking the penalty and Pettersson was a huge part of killing it off. But the fact that they have Pettersson to throw over the boards in that situation, right, means that I think it's a little less like fated that they're going to lose, fated that they're going to give up two or three glorious rush chances the other way. So I think that matters a lot in terms of this team's construction and ability to sort of maximize their points haul down the stretch here.
Yeah, it's obviously we'll have the debate. We'll continue to have the debate about the value going the other way in that deal, and especially if it ends up being the Gavin McKenna pick next year, that'll be very interesting. But there's no denying that he is bringing something much, much needed to the Canucks, adding to the blue line. Just quick look ahead to this game tonight. We didn't really get a chance to touch on it. You know, obviously, as Dim was saying earlier about the Ducks, a pretty frustrating team to watch. Major questions about whether Cronin is getting the most out of some of those young players.
No, those aren't questions. That's fact.
I'm being
fact.
Polite.
The answer's no.
I'm being polite.
Why?
Trance.
Why are you being polite?
I don't know. It's just my way.
I do think there's like an element to which I get wanting to teach young players how to win the right way, and that's important. I'm not minimizing it. But I think the Columbus Blue Jackets are a fascinating object lesson. In that, you know, Jarmo Kekalainen basically assembled this core, right? Like, nailed the Marchenko pick. You know, Chinnikov's even, like, interesting given where he was selected and sort of what went around him. Obviously, Fantilli, Kent Johnson. I mean, just reams of talent, right, that they've been able to bring in to this organization. And they bring in Babcock, and he never even coaches a game. I mean, it's the most disastrous head coaching hire ever. But even if he had made it, you know, like Taskmaster Babcock with this young up and coming, you know, juice flowing like an orchard Blue Jackets lineup. Like, who cares? That's not interesting. Babcock's really good at like helping teams drive entry differential and dominate play. And if you give him a group of veterans, like, that's great. But I mean, not only did he not even make it to game one of the season, but even if he had, that's not the right team, I don't think, for a coach like that. Like, what you've seen with Dean Evason, where it's like, go out and play, learn how to dominate at the NHL level, like, let's have some fun, let's keep the vibes good, let's play exciting, thrilling hockey. I think if you're one of those young teams, and Anaheim should be one of those young teams too, it's like, play hockey in an environment that allows all of your young players to sort of test the limits and find out what they can be, and then when you're ready, begin to emphasize the sort of sacrifices that you have to make to win. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like that tends to be, and we've seen this time and time again with like Tampa Bay. You know, Chicago did it on an accelerated sort of timeline, but like the Washington Capitals, right? I mean, when you go through with these great teams that have these great young cores that all sort of come up together at the same time, like, figure out what you can do at the NHL level, and then I think get serious about how to put it together in a winning mold. I think when you put the try to like teach these young players how to win, what it takes to win, you know, which is important. Like, I'm not saying it's not important, but on the as like a continuum, as a balance, I think you want to veer toward getting the most out of them, building up their confidence, letting them explore and figure out, you know, how what it takes to like dominate and score and put up points and make the difference in the NHL. Because otherwise you end up like with what the Ducks have, where they play boring hockey, it's overly structured, they're still giving up a million chances, and across the board, Leo Carlson, Mason McTavish, Trevor Zegras are all regressing, you know, in terms yep. of who they are as players. And if that happens, I don't care how structurally sound you are, you're dead in the water. Those players need to be carrying you. So I just feel like Columbus and Anaheim are fascinating object lessons in sort of the two sides of the developmental coin. And I just know which I prefer to watch and which I'm far more confident in delivering actual results over the next few years.
I think a lot of like taskmaster coaches, sometimes the ones that don't end up being successful, sometimes they like, they mistake the ends for the means. You know what I mean? Which is like the tough love is supposed to be a tool to get the most out of your players. It's not an end unto itself. And I think sometimes that gets lost where it's like, well, I'm being hard on them because that's what you're supposed to do. It's like, well, you're supposed to do if it works, but if it's not working, then you got to try something else. And it's not just something you have to do to check off a box in your coaching career and part of the development of young players. And I think, again, for the unsuccessful guys in that mold, sometimes it feels like that line gets blurred a little bit. All right, we'll end things there for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Actually, I will be back tomorrow. Drance will be traveling, so no Drance on the show tomorrow. He'll be back on Monday, but I will be here going into the weekend and breaking down the game between the Canucks and the Ducks. That is tomorrow on Canucks Talks Sportsnet 650.